You're listening to Locally Sourced Science, your connection to the scientific discoveries happening in the Finger Lakes community.
Hi, I'm Esther Rakusin, and you're listening to Locally Sourced Science. We are about halfway into the month of April, and spring has sprung. That means that, as we look around and see trees start to bud, perennial flowers sprouting, and the sounds of peepers at night, we know that Earth Day, April 22nd, is coming up soon. Thus, here is the Earth Day edition of Locally Sourced Science. When you think of Earth, we think of a lot of things: the planet that we live on, the ground below our feet, and, at a deeper level, pardon the pun, the soil that supports the plants that we all depend on for life. So we start off with Candace Limper's conversation with soil scientist Joseph Amsili, an extension associate in the Soil and Crop Sciences section at Cornell University. They discuss how we can manage our soils better and how paying attention to soils can benefit the planet. After that, Liz Mahood presents a short history of the science of climate change. Later on in the show, you'll hear my feature about Cornell scientists doing research on renewable energy. And last but not least, you'll hear Patricia Waldron present a calendar of Earth Day events coming up later this month. So without further ado, here is Candace Limper and her conversation with Joseph Amsili.
My name is Joseph Amsili, longtime resident of Ithaca, New York, and I'm an extension associate with Cornell University, and I'm part of the Cornell Soil Health Program. Broadly speaking, and now I'm kind of a generalist in soil science, so know a little bit about a lot of the fields of soil science.
So the jack of all trades of soil.
Yeah, something like that. And that's okay. Soil health is really a comprehensive and holistic way of thinking about soil functioning in soil. One exciting part about soil is that we can, by managing our soils better and both protecting, both not losing all of our organic matter in our soils, we can reduce our fluxes of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere while also improving the soil quality. One reason that people have really latched on to the concept of soil health is because only living things can be healthy. And oftentimes we don't think of the soil as being alive, but the reason that we think of, that I think of the soil as being alive, is because the functions that we think of as soil functions are dependent on life in the soil.
In terms of the general public, what would you want them to know to better the soil in their surrounding areas?
Appreciate that soils are a complex, living, dynamic volume. It's not just a solid material that supports plant growth. There's a lot of life in the soil that makes all of that possible. My discipline in soils is called biogeochemistry, which is a mouthful, but it basically is all about understanding the interactions of life in the soil and how it relates to the geology and the chemistry. So
are you interested in like particular microbes or like worms or don't know, bugs in there? Or
I love all soil organisms. Plant pathologists study different types of soils can actually suppress certain types of plant pathogens.
Wow.
That, like, they've learned, like, analogous to human health, the diversity of organisms in our gut. People have shown that that certain soils are better at suppressing certain pathogens than other soils, and some of that might have to do with specific relationships between microbes or just a general diversity and checks and balance of the soil helping suppress certain disease-causing organisms. In terms of the effect on the soil, I would guess I would argue that in terms of like a mass balance or thinking of influencing the soil, a lot of it has to do with kind of a good way of thinking of it is build it and the soil organisms will come or something like that. So using crop rotations and reducing tillage that help build soil organic matter.
What are those crop rotations and crop tillage?
So I guess one thing you could analogous to natural systems is natural systems never have no living plants growing on it. By having living plants growing on a soil, you are feeding the life in the soil. So basically like natural systems, having living plants growing on the soil surface helps support and create a healthier soil than if you don't have those living plants, because plants are pumping carbon, and which helps feed the life in the soil, because when you're deep in the soil, you can't photosynthesize. So that's really nice to have those roots supplying you with sugars and stuff that you can make your biomass and do the different functions you do.
If a farmer isn't growing anything, do they fertilize the soil and not the fertilization for the plants?
No, they wouldn't do that because it's fertilizers that expensive and represents an input that costs money, and they're trying to manage their system for optimum profitability. But one of the things that people don't always think about, which is kind of interesting, is that nitrogen is the most important limiting nutrient for crop growth and made available in an inorganic form for plants to take it up. One really difficult thing about managing nitrogen is that it's difficult to predict how much you should add in a given year. So one thing my supervisor works on is this adaptive nitrogen management software that takes into account the weather, because if you have a big rainfall event, then if you have just applied fertilizer, then a lot of that nitrogen will leach through the soil. So basically, understanding the right amount of nitrogen to add is complicated. Optimizing nitrogen application to be synchronized with plant uptake is actually a really big challenge, and is what a lot of soil scientists and agronomists work on.
Why is that hard to assay?
So nitrogen, soil nitrogen and soil or nitrogen availability, you can test for it at a certain point, but at that point is not going to reflect the availability for that season. So if someone's doing a soil test, the reason there's no routine soil nitrogen test that you would get if you sent your samples up to Agro One, which is the main testing facility for New York, is that number is maybe meaningful for when you extracted it. If you extracted it when plants are growing, it's probably going to be very low.
If you have a healthy soil, do you have more nutrients within the plants?
Well, that's complicated, but definitely the more soil organic matter you have in your soil, the larger your reservoir is for these nutrients, especially nitrogen, but all the whole suite of nutrients. Organic matter is made up of all these different elements, all these different macro and micronutrients, and the larger pool, and as microbes are breaking that organic matter down, they're making these inorganic nutrients available for plants. So the larger your total soil organic matter pool is, the larger reservoir of slow release fertilizer you have for your crops.
Do you think if we treated the soil better, we might have less pollution? Yeah?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. I think people say that 50% of the applied synthetic fertilizer is not taken up by crops and is leached through the soil profile, and it creates big problems in the Gulf of Mexico with dead zones and dead zones all over the world where we have similar amounts of high amounts of agricultural runoff going into our water bodies.
So where does this synthetic nitrogen come from that these farmers are buying?
Yeah, so synthetic nitrogen, basically, sometime after World War One, we figured out how to synthesize inorganic nitrogen. And whereas bacteria and the root of growing in a nodule in the in the root of a legume can do it at normal temperatures. We use natural gas, so it's a very fossil fuel dependent production where we're basically using an iron catalyst and like 500 Celsius to separate the nitrogen bond and create synthetic fertilizer.
So it's very energy consuming.
It's very energy intensive, yeah.
Okay.
And that's the reason that nitrogen fertilizer prices are correlated with fossil fuel prices. So when we had, when gas was going up to $4-$5 a gallon, we were seeing synchronous rises in fertilizer prices, which farmers feel. And that's another reason that people are getting excited about soil health, because you can do any effort to reduce the nitrogen fertilizer you're applying is also money in your pocket. And I think we, as a country and as a world, we're understanding that there's something to this whole building healthy soils, and there's benefits for the public in terms of cleaner water or
No more blooms.
Yeah, more carbon in the soil, less dead zones, yeah. Lower nitrate levels in our groundwater, and there's can be benefits for our farmers. And there's so I think we're starting to see that, and hopefully as consumers, we're starting to value these different practices that go into farming.
So as a customer, how do you use your money in the right places to know who's doing the right kind of farming?
Yeah. So locally, the reason I got interested in soil science is vegetable farming. So I grew up doing some vegetable farming, and for me, a nice thing about living here and living in an agricultural area in general is that you can have a relationship with your producers and know where your food came from. Maybe you have a relationship with the farm and you're trading labor for food or something like that, that know what goes into farming, because farming is a lot of work.
I feel like we're so out of touch with food.
Yeah.
Like, and as a society.
It's easy to want all these things from farmers, but without understanding the economic system that they're in is really unfair to the producer. One important thing is to just learn more about food production and where your food comes from, and are there things that you're purchasing that aren't supporting what you say you want to support or something like that.
Yeah, I think people are being more sensitive now
than
maybe 20 years ago.
No, one thing that is really awesome about soil health is it seems to me to be one of the only things that cuts across a lot of the things that divide us in society today. A lot of people from all walks really, really are getting behind the soil health concept. And I think there's benefits for everyone. And the reason I think people are using this language is it speaks to a lot of people.
You're listening to Locally Sourced Science. You can listen to our show alternate Sundays at 5 p.m. and alternate Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. on WRFI.org. Our next show will be April 28th. And you can also subscribe to new episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and other podcast apps. Head to our website at locallysourcedscience.org for podcast links and our show archive. For this special Earth Day show, we are featuring a drawing to win a membership to Cornell Botanic Gardens. Send us an email by April 30th, 2019 at locallysourcedscience@gmail.com. A winner will be drawn from all the emails that we receive by that date. And now, here is Liz Mahood.
Hello, Locally Sourced Science listeners. I'm Liz Mahood, and for this special Earth Day episode, I've put together a very brief history on the scientific discoveries behind a rather controversial topic, climate change. This history is in no way comprehensive, since it is only about 3 minutes. The first discoveries in this field actually happened in the mid to late 1800s and early 1900s. During this time, the field of thermodynamics was just beginning, driven by the steam engine industry. In the 1860s, John Tyndall determined that water vapor and carbon dioxide could trap infrared energy on Earth. At the end of the 1800s, savant Arrhenius considered the effects of increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere on the Earth's temperature. He found that, you guessed it, increasing the concentration of carbon dioxide would warm the planet. Specifically, that doubling it would raise the planetary temperature by 5 to 6 degrees Celsius. In 1938, the first tracking of carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere was conducted by Gad Callander, who found that levels had risen to be 110% of the level seen in the late 1800s. In the late 1950s, armed with more advanced technology and the knowledge that carbon dioxide levels were increasing and had an effect on planetary temperature, a concerted effort was made to monitor atmospheric carbon dioxide levels. A station on the top of Mauna Loa, Hawaii, was established and is still maintained today. This monitoring station found that carbon dioxide levels were, and are, steadily rising. At that point, and until the 1980s, this research did not have much effect on governmental policies. At the time, public environmental concern was largely focused on smaller-scale pollution events. This largely changed in the 1980s, when three British Atlantic Survey scientists discovered the Antarctic ozone hole. This finding, coupled with newly released satellite images of the hole, was a realization that the ozone layer was being depleted faster than anyone had predicted. This was determined to be largely the result of CFC release into the atmosphere. These findings led to the creation of governmental panels that developed policies to address ozone depletion, greenhouse warming, subsequent biodiversity loss, and best practices for development in light of these issues. In the early 2000s, comprehensive reviews on the responses of animal and plant life to global warming began to be published. The consistent mass loss of ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica were also initially recorded at this time. This brings us to the current questions facing the field of climate science today. Many of the uncertainties in the field are about projections into the future. For example, how extreme weather events will change, and by how much ocean levels will rise is still under debate. According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a factor not under debate is the implication of human activities as the agent for climate change. If you would like a comprehensive list of sources used in the creation of this history, please see our website at www.locallysourcedscience.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Liz Mahood.
Next up is my feature on Cornell scientists studying renewable energy sources. Increasing amounts of greenhouse gases in Earth's atmosphere are fueling severe weather events. So, to curb the effects of climate change, countries around the world need to decrease their use of fossil fuels as energy sources. Scientists are developing ways to optimize renewable energy sources such as wind, solar, and battery technologies. To learn more about research on new energy sources, I attended the poster session at the Cornell Energy Systems Institute Energy Day. The first ever event was held Wednesday, April 10th, 2019. About 30 energy research scientists presented their data at the poster session. I started off by talking with Cornell undergraduate Hannah Grant. She is one of the leaders of a new club called Cornell Energy Systems Club. Here, she describes why her club organized Energy Day.
So Cornell Energy Systems Club is a newly found club founded by the director of the Cornell Energy Systems Institute, Lyndon Archer. And so he put together a group of students, and this is our first event ever. We're a new club. And so our purpose is we noticed a lack of opportunities for students to get involved in energy on campus, especially connecting with industry. So our main job is to connect students with faculty and industry people so that they can form those relationships and be involved in energy.
Jae-Fu Yin is the lab manager of the Cornell Energy Systems Institute. The institute runs a laboratory where material science researchers can test materials used for improved energy storage.
I want to show people the ability and the opportunities in our center. I want to make the center more popular to the community. I want people to come and use our facility. I want people find opportunity for their research, for their projects, and we want to help people.
He described how scientists are testing new polymers that could be used as electrolytes for lithium batteries.
For example, people design polymer materials for electrolyte to protect the electrode surface, but you need a way to characterize your polymer. And people stop by here, and they do a lot of characterization on their polymers, and they also set up batteries. We have battery testers. We have multiple battery testers for people. We can provide temperature control, environment control, and we also offer the opportunity to study the electrochemical reaction which happens behind the battery.
Zach Lee is a graduate student who is working to optimize the function of air source heat pumps used for heating and cooling in residences.
So my work is primarily with heat pump control. So a lot of homes, specifically in the Northeast, are fueled are heated by natural gas or propane or fuel oil. So that's currently cheaper than some kind of electric heating. And so my job is to try to fix that. But there comes with two main problems. Heat pumps are not quite cost effective. The form of electric energy is not very efficient in cold weather. So I'm using smart thermostats at Maplewood Apartments in Ithaca to basically control your heat pumps so that they operate at the most efficient time and they can operate when there's clean energy on the grid, so when the sun is shining or when the wind is blowing. And so I'm using machine learning, a type of artificial intelligence, to basically learn the properties of, say, some specific home without having to go to the home and figure out the square footage or the insulation values or anything like that. That way you can just load a program onto your thermostat and it will learn how your home operates. And it'll automatically run your electric heating to, one, save you the most money, and two, operate when the energy on the electrical grid is clean.
Srayam Sina is a graduate student who is working on a new way to charge car batteries called capacitive wireless power systems. Here he describes how it would work.
What we can do is we can charge the electric vehicle from the road on the go wirelessly. What that would do is, let's say you have a charger at every traffic signal, so it can charge a little bit on every traffic signal and keep going. So all it takes is have a little bit of energy so that you can go to the next traffic signal. So the battery can be very, very small, the cost can come down, and the penetration of electrical vehicle in the market will go up. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea of the research.
He then talked about why electric vehicle technology is important and essential.
Because of the environment, because fossil fuels are going to run out, and of course you need power to run the EV, and you cannot get so much power from solar, so of course you want for battery. And the problem with the battery is that you need a lot of energy to store, so a lot of cost, a lot of weight, and that's why this wireless charging technology can really, really help in sustaining energy for electric vehicles.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Esther Rakusin for Locally Sourced Science, and I'm speaking with scientists at the first ever Energy Day sponsored by Cornell Energy Systems Institute. Emily Lizbiza is a student working on her master's in systems engineering. She is working on a study exploring the effects of weather damage to wind turbine blades.
Basically, overall, we're trying to study leading edge erosion on wind turbine blades. And what leading edge really refers to is the edge of the blade, which is most in contact with the air as it's moving through, and it moves the fastest. And so those can typically move as quickly as 70 meters per second, which is very, very fast. And so what happens a lot of the time is the edge of the blades will erode over time, and that's really bad. It can lead to 5% or worse decreases in efficiency when they're moving through the air, which is really bad for wind farms. And so what we're trying to do is use different testing, Instron testing and hardness testing, to kind of match material properties to that of something we can 3D print in-house. We're going to use a power washer, like any power washer you would see at home, because they move, the water out of those guys moves really fast. And we're going to try to simulate water droplets and shoot them at a blade and see if we can try to recreate leading edge erosion and figure out how much energy is transferred to the blade.
I also spoke with Alex Lee, a student who wants to encourage students to decrease their carbon footprint.
So my poster is about Green Club, which is a startup that I'm working on with a couple of teammates. And our mission is to make it really simple for any person to start offsetting their carbon footprint and saving the earth while saving money at the same time. In order to do this, we offer a really simple monthly service where you will reduce your carbon footprint by 680 pounds of CO2 each month. And in return, you'll get access to special discounts and promotions we have with our partnering businesses. So I think it's really important to be transparent about where your money is going and how it's actually offsetting your carbon footprint. So right now we're working with the Finger Lakes Climate Fund, which is a nonprofit that offers carbon offsets that improve the local Tompkins County area. We're also working with industry partners. There's a company called 3Degrees that offers offsets that focus on things like reforestation and also greenhouse gas capture.
I asked him how the estimate of 680 pounds of carbon per month was calculated.
That came up through some research and reading literature online where we wanted to find out what is the average footprint for college students. And so that number takes into account things like your daily travel, maybe car rides or bus rides, electricity usage in apartments, and also the food that you consume.
He talked about why this project is important.
I think the problem that we want to tackle is one of the most important problems, climate change and also personal accountability for climate change. So we want to engage the public and allow them to understand that they can make an impact and that their personal decisions matter when it comes to stopping huge problems like climate change. And I think that we're offering a really unique solution to this, one that's really simple and cost-effective. And that's why we're really passionate about this project.
Following the poster session at the first ever Energy Day at Cornell, it was evident that a large variety of scientists are dedicated to finding ways to enhance renewable energy sources and reduce the carbon footprint of energy systems. For Locally Sourced Science, I'm Esther Rakusin. Here is Patricia Waldron with the Earth Day Events Roundup.
Hello, this is Patricia Waldron from Locally Sourced Science. This week, the Museum of the Earth is open every day during spring break, April 15th through 19th, with special activities related to their exhibit, Survivors, Up Close with Living Fossils. Also, the museum will hold its annual Dino Extravaganza on Saturday, April 20th from 10 to 1 p.m. Learn more about these events on their website at priweb.org. The Finger Lakes Native Plant Society is hosting a talk on the botanical treasures of the gorge at Buttermilk Falls State Park. Professional photographer and amateur botanist Araya Tall will show his photos of the native plant life that grows along the rocks of the gorge. The free talk will be held in the Unitarian Church Annex in Ithaca on the second floor on Wednesday, April 17th from 7 to 9 p.m. Learn more on their website, flnps.org. With Earth Day coming up on April 22nd, there are numerous events going on in the region to celebrate the day. The Finger Lakes Land Trust is holding an Earth Day Volunteer Work Day at Owasco Lake Preserve from 10 to 1 on Saturday, April 20th. The group will be installing deer fencing and clearing brush from a farm field that is being turned back into a meadow habitat. Find out more on their website, fllt.org. The Cornell Cooperative Extension is holding a free event called Climate Wise Gardening, an Earthkeeping Fair, on Saturday, April 27th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Boynton Middle School in Ithaca. The fair will have hands-on activities, demonstrations, talks, and films showing how people can protect the earth and support wildlife through their gardens. And those are just some of the science events happening in the Finger Lakes area. For Locally Sourced Science, I'm Patricia Waldron.
I'm Esther Rakusin, and you've been listening to Locally Sourced Science. I produced today's show and the segment on Cornell's Energy Day. Candace Limper produced today's interview, Liz Mahood compiled climate science history, and Patricia Waldron wrote the Earth Day events calendar. You can subscribe to new episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and other podcast apps. Head to our website at locallysourcedscience.org for podcast links and our show archive. Don't forget Mother Earth. Celebrate Earth Day on April 22nd. Thank you.